Good afternoon, counsel.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Peter Walsh for Defendant Below's Appellees. It's my pleasure to introduce my co-counsel in this matter, Kevin Reed of Quinn Emanuel, Urquhart, Oliver, and Hedges. Mr. Reed will be making the argument on behalf of the appellees. Also seated at counsel's table is Kevin Janis of the Quinn Emanuel firm. And also in the courtroom is Eva Kalowski, who is the Executive Vice President and General Counsel of Platinum Equity. Thank you.
Welcome, counsel.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. And members of the court, my name is Dan Folt of the law firm Duane Morris, and we represent the Roan parties. It's my pleasure today to introduce my partners, John Sirocco first, who will present argument for us today, and John Delaportis. And we also have with us in the back of the courtroom Mr. Horace Ward, who's the former CEO of Roan and the administrator in bankruptcy. Thank you.
Welcome. Whenever you're ready.
Your Honor, I've indicated to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. May it please the Court. This is a case where the Superior Court's decision must be reversed because the Superior Court, on the one hand, applied a wrong legal standard to a finding which, on the other hand, it had made correctly. Basically, under the Superior Court's decision, Platinum was allowed to terminate without any consequences an acquisition agreement by which it was going to buy some cellular towers from Roan. The trigger for that walkaway provision was that Platinum had to first, in good faith, make a determination, and second, that determination in all accounts had to have a reasonable basis in law and fact that by making that acquisition of those cellular towers, it would, based on the law and based on the facts, face material asbestos liability. The Superior Court found that there was absolutely no reasonable or objective basis on which Platinum Equity could ever have believed that. And since the agreement specifically required Platinum Equity to be operating on such an objective and reasonable basis, that should have been the end of the case, and judgment should have been for Roan and against Platinum Equity, because Platinum Equity, by terminating as it did, breached the contract. It attempted to pull the trigger on a walkaway provision, the predicate for which the Superior Court correctly found was not met in this case, and in fact the Superior Court was absolutely emphatic on that point. As an objective basis in law and fact, Platinum Equity had no reason to fear any asbestos liability. Again, that should have been the end of the matter. Where the Superior Court appeared to have gotten detoured was that the Superior Court looked at the words determine in good faith and in effect found an alternative escape hatch for Platinum Equity. In effect, the Superior Court decoupled the notion of good faith from the notion of reasonable basis in law and fact and found that since Platinum Equity had acted in the Superior Court's mind in good faith, they were entitled to terminate without consequence. That specific determination was wrong for at least several reasons. Number one, you simply can't decouple good faith and reasonable basis in fact. In Delaware law, we know that because there was a case, Wilmington Leasing, written by Justice Jacobs when Justice Jacobs was on the Superior, on the Chancery Court, in 1996, which spoke directly to this point. Someone was attempting to terminate someone under the contract. The person was required to have a reasonable basis for doing that, and the plaintiff in that case argued, well, as long as I operate in good faith, I don't need to show you that I really had an objective, reasonable basis, and vice Chancellor, then Vice Chancellor Jacob, said that the requirements of reasonableness and the requirements of good faith can't be decoupled. Decoupled was the word used in that opinion, in the way urged by the plaintiff. And that case is at 1996 Delaware Chancery, Lexis 123. New York law is exactly the same. In fact, under New York law, the words good faith almost always mean having a reasonable and objective basis. The best statement of New York law on that point is the J.D. Cousins case. That's a decision of the Second Circuit applying New York law. And what the Second Circuit said in that case is that the general rule, it's reflected in the restatement, it's reflected in the UCC, is when you see the words in good faith and you're talking about a commercial transaction, it means you have to have a reasonable, objective basis. Only in certain very limited cases, cases involving what the cases call taste and whim, are those cases reviewable strictly for good faith. For instance, if I order an oil portrait of my dog, my daughter, whatever, and I say, I'll buy it if it's satisfactory to me, that is a matter of taste and whim. And therefore, if I decline to purchase the painting in the end after the painter's painted it on my commission, that would only be reviewable by a court for good faith, because there's really no objective standard you can apply to whether I believe that a painter has captured the spirit of my Cocker Spaniel. But when you're buying cellular towers, and the only excuse you have not to buy them is whether the acquisition of those cellular towers will inflict upon you liability for asbestos, and as the Superior Court found, there was no way on earth to possibly reach that conclusion as a matter of law or fact, then you can't simply rely on the fact that you acted in good faith. That's not good enough, and that's the dictate of New York law. Delaware law happens to be the same. It was followed on exactly that point in the Wilmington leasing case.
There's nothing wrong, though, if the parties choose to, in a commercial transaction, to incorporate the taste and whim standard.
Justice Ridgely, absolutely not. But the key point here is, and it's quite clear, they did not. They could have done any number of things. They could have said, Platinum is given the total discretion to walk away. Platinum is given a right to walk away, assuming it gets a legal opinion. Or Platinum is given the right to walk away, assuming the Phillies win the World Series. But what was in fact specified in the contract was, narrowly, Platinum only had the right to walk away if, first in good faith, it then reached a determination that as a matter of law and fact, it would face asbestos liability. The Superior Court drilled into that issue and found there was simply no way on earth Platinum could have reasonably believed that by buying non-asbestos assets from Roan, certain cellular towers, it was going to be exposed to asbestos liability. It wasn't merging with Roan. It wasn't acquiring Roan. It wasn't continuing the business of Roan. It would be, and I think this example was used the last time, it would be like me buying a typewriter from Johns Manville and being told, well, now you're going to have all the asbestos liability that the Johns Manville Company has ever had because you bought an asset from them.
Mr. Rocco, the Platinum does take your argument head on. You said several times that I think it's correct that the Superior Court held that there was no way on earth objectively speaking, there was a reasonable basis to conclude that there would be any liability, let alone material liability, for asbestos. The other side disagrees and advances several arguments basically attacking that determination.
Right.
What is your response?
My response to that is the following, Your Honor. First, That battle of perspectives on that was addressed by the Superior Court, and we know how the Superior Court ruled. The Superior Court ruled simply, quote, there was no reasonable basis in law or fact for the termination of the agreement.
Well, how are we supposed to review that? The other side said that is erroneous.
Well,
there was a reasonable basis in law and fact. So even by your own criterion, there should be an affirmance.
Let's assume for the moment that this court was hearing that question in the first instance. Under the benchmarks or hallmarks of this transaction, I would submit that this court, no court, could conclude that because I buy some cellular towers from a company, I don't merge with them, I don't acquire their business, all I do is buy selected assets, and I buy them from a company that is protected by a channeling injunction, where claims have already been discharged, where they haven't paid a dime on asbestos claims for 13 years. This is what I believe was referred to the last time as sort of the corporate law 101. The opinion, such as it was, and I really don't even believe it was an opinion, but the reaction that Platinum got from the legal counsel that it looked to for this matter never addressed the issue that even without all of the protections of the channeling injunction, the discharge, the affirmance by the Seventh Circuit, all that was happening here was Company A was buying some selected assets from Company B.
Perhaps I didn't ask my question clearly enough. What you've done is to recite all of the arguments in favor of your side and that the Superior Court accepted. What I'm asking you to do is address the arguments that are now being advanced by the other side and tell us why they're wrong.
Well, they're wrong because in the end, you either have emanating from a transaction the possibility for liability or you don't. What I'm trying to respond to, Justice Jacobs, is all the factors that you would look to in making a decision as to whether this transaction was potentially perilous to Platinum Equity on the issue of whether they would acquire material asbestos liability. There are no points in this case that point to any reasonable concern on the part of Platinum Equity relative to asbestos liability because, simply put, they were only acquiring selected assets, not continuing the business, not becoming the successor in interest, not merging, and under corporate law successor liability type principles, when Company A buys a few assets from Company B, Company A is not exposed to the liabilities of Company B. In reality, when you drill into what actually occurred in this case, what Platinum really heard back from its legal counsel wasn't the fact that you will be liable because you've bought some cellular towers, you'll now be liable for asbestos liability. What it really heard back was the viewpoint that, well, you may or may not be liable, but others may think you're liable and may sue you. They may think you're liable and may sue you. But as we reviewed the last time, liability or exposure to asbestos liability is a term of art. It means being liable to the claimants. It doesn't mean the fact that you might incur a few dollars successfully defending the cases. And there's another Delaware case that's right on point with that one. It's another Chancery Court decision by Vice Chancellor Noble. It's cited in our briefs, and it's called Frontier Oil. It's right on point. Here's what happened in Frontier Oil. It was another transaction of this general type and stripe, and the agreement had a material adverse event clause that would have entitled the acquirer to terminate the provision. In that case, the real-life Aaron Brockovich, the lawyer in California about whom they made the movie, threatened the acquirer with a lawsuit. The party, the acquirer, said, well, that threatened lawsuit could cause us to spend money to defend ourselves. That's a material adverse event. And Vice Chancellor Noble disagreed. The bottom line of Frontier Oil is that's not what liability is, spending some money to defend yourself when you in fact have no liability, and he refused to allow them to terminate on the basis of that alleged material adverse event. It's the same thing in this case.
Is it a fair characterization of your side's position that we, the Supreme Court, must review Judge Del Pesco's determination de novo, but even under a de novo review, your side wins?
Absolutely. And my position is further that, like Judge Del Pesco, I submit the matter is not close. And when you really drill into the record and find the gravamen of what it is that Platinum Equity heard from its counsel. Remember, these people, Platinum Equity, they got no formal legal opinion. They didn't even really get a letter. But what they kind of heard back, the vibrations, if you will, were that, well, you know, people may think because you purchase these cellular towers that somehow you might be good people to sue, asbestos claimants might sue you. But there'd be no basis for that. Frankly, as a factual matter, that hadn't happened to Roan for 13 years. But even if you wanted to pretend that, in fact, was going to happen, that's not what exposure for asbestos liability, which is a term of art, means under that walkaway provision. If it meant that under the walkaway provision, the protection that Roan had under the walkaway provision would be totally illusory. Because then all a party in Platinum Equity's position would ever have to say was, I had a sleepless night last night worrying about the legal bills I might run up, proving I in fact had no asbestos liability. It would give them really the total discretion to walk away whenever they subjectively felt that legal bills to prove their innocence or concern over litigation was causing them to want to rethink the transaction. But that's not what an objective basis in law, in fact, means under New York law. It's not what was intended by it in this provision. What it meant was a protection for Roan. This case could not be, this transaction could not be terminated by Platinum unless first in good faith Platinum reached a determination that was specific, and the determination it had to reach specifically was that based on the law and based on the facts, it would be subject to liability for asbestos claims. That isn't even what Platinum Equity heard from its own counsel.
Let me interrupt for a second. If it's as clear as you would have us believe that there is no reasonable basis in law, in fact, for concern about material liability, then how could a decision have been made in good faith to the contrary?
I don't believe it could have been made in good faith to the contrary.
But the court below said no basis, but it was in good faith. How do you explain that?
The court below, unfortunately, did not understand the directive and burden of New York law on this point. What New York law says, and the best examples of it are the cases cited in our brief, J.B. Cousins, Alper Blouse, is that when you see the words good faith appearing in such a provision in a commercial context, plain old transaction for widgets as opposed to baking a cake or painting a painting, what that means is objective basis in law and fact. In fact, what the Superior Court got detoured on was the notion that this walk-away provision could be triggered on an alternative basis. It's exactly what Vice Chancellor Jacobs wouldn't allow in the Wilmington leasing case. In the Wilmington leasing case, the parties in front of the court there said, well, we may not have a reasonable objective basis for doing what we're doing, but believe us, we're operating in good faith. And what Vice Chancellor Jacobs did in that case under Delaware law, and the result's exactly the same under New York law, he said the one thing you can't do is decouple these concepts of good faith and reasonable basis in law and fact. That's the error, Madam Justice, that the Superior Court made in this case. In effect, the Superior Court created another escape hatch for Platinum in this case where one did not exist. It gave Platinum the escape hatch of acting in good faith. Now, I believe there are a lot of defects in this case to show why Platinum didn't act in good faith anyway in terms of their interaction with the lawyer, how shoddy the legal work was, how fragmentary the questions were, wrong questions were asked, the right questions weren't answered. But even if you want to grant all of that, that door that the Superior Court let Platinum go out simply does not exist as a matter of law under New York law. That was the error.
You want to save the balance of your time?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes.
May it please the Court. My name is Kevin Reed, appearing on behalf of Appalese. The decision of the Superior Court should be affirmed. The Superior Court determined correctly, first, that Platinum's determination that it had a reasonable basis in law and in fact to fear a material asbestos liability was made in good faith and subject to...
Could you summarize what you think the legal opinion they received was?
I think the legal opinion they received was in essence this. The channeling injunction that Roan has promoted as foreclosing any possibility of asbestos liability does not in fact do that, because it does not, there is a reasonable possibility that it will be found not to comply with the grandfathering requirements of Section 524H of the Bankruptcy Code. If in fact...
How can you be heard to argue that when the Superior Court has found to the contrary, and you haven't cross-appealed? That is, you seem to be trying to have the best of both worlds. You're taking on the Superior Court's finding that's adverse to your position, but only as an appellee, not as a cross-appellant.
My understanding, Your Honor, and I apologize if I'm incorrect on this, is that we're entitled to argue for an affirmance on any possible basis. I wasn't aware that we would need to cross-appeal. I think we argue first that affirmance should issue because the court was correct in finding that we were subject only to good faith review and that we did, in fact, act in good faith. But as an alternative basis, we can be affirmed because our action was objectively reasonable.
Going back to where you were in answering my question, you seem to be saying that if the channeling injunction had some type of problem, that there could have been real asbestos liability as opposed to just incurring legal expenses?
I don't think that's our position. I think the lawyer raised the possibility that you might incur a judgment down the road, but that really wasn't the thrust of his opinion, and it wasn't the basis on which we acted.
Okay.
The thrust was...
Go ahead. That's what I'm trying to get at. What was the opinion? Because it's been characterized, as your opponent has, and no one ever told you you were had a likelihood or substantial likelihood of incurring asbestos liability. And the opinion was, if there really is some daylight in this channeling injunction, you're going to wind up paying a lot of legal expenses to prove that you don't have any asbestos liability. Is that the opinion?
I think that's a fair summary of it. I would refer the court to page B91 of the appendix, which is an email that counsel sent at the time, which summarizes the advice of counsel. And there's testimony in the record establishing those facts. Mr. Sirocco spent a lot of time.
But for our purposes, are you content with us focusing on your concern was not a judgment saying you had asbestos liability? Your concern was getting pulled into litigation and spending a lot of money proving you had no liability.
I'm content for you to focus on that.
Okay.
And the reason, and I think what our opponents try to ignore, is the context in which this all occurs. We're not talking about the possibility that there may be one or two claims filed and we may be required to spend tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands in legal fees. We're talking about asbestos liability, where it's not a matter of one or two claims, it's a matter of thousands of claims and millions of dollars. And, in fact, we had expert testimony, which the court heard, which quantified the potential exposure as somewhere in the neighborhood of at least $35 million. So the concern overall is that...
Excuse me, that's just for attorney's fees?
Yes. The concern overall is that the channeling injunction is breached. Plaintiffs across the country see a new deep pocket. Plaintiffs' lawyers, rather, see a new deep pocket. They rush into courts everywhere, and we may win every one of those cases, but we'll spend millions of dollars doing it. And that wasn't a price that we were willing to pay for a deal where the record shows...
Well, wouldn't you get Rule 11 sanctions in every one of those cases because of the corporate law 101 discussion that we had last time regarding the fact that this was not a merger where liabilities were assumed?
You might not. First of all, your concern would be that you'd be in state courts across the country, not necessarily federal courts, where there is no Rule 11. Secondly, even to make those motions, you're spending significant sums, and you might lose one or two. And more than that, you know, the notion that corporate law 101 automatically is sort of the silver bullet that kills this, I think is belied by the fact that it may ultimately be true, but the obviousness of it is belied by the fact that nobody raised this at the time. When Platinum first raised the idea that it was considering terminating this agreement on the basis of this concern about asbestos liability, the record shows that what Prone came back with was there's a channeling injunction in place. We haven't had any claims for dozens of years. Nobody ever said, oh, and as a matter of law, successor liability, you can't possibly be held liable, which I raise again, not to show that successor liability principles wouldn't ultimately have protected us, but simply to show that it wasn't this glaring, obvious fact that people just willfully ignore.
Just for purposes of hypothetical assumptions, let's suppose the magnitude of the deal was the same, but it really was typewriters and not these towers. Would your argument be exactly the same, that you could walk away from this typewriter transaction, or is there something about the towers that helps your argument?
No, there's nothing about the towers that helps our argument. I think if we had been purchasing typewriters, and in the extraordinarily unlikely event that, I won't characterize it that way. If we had been purchasing typewriters, and if we had gotten an opinion from a Yale-educated lawyer at Kirkland & Ellis that we had worked with 20 times in the past, that purchasing those typewriters could give rise to a breach of the channeling injunction and $35 million in defense costs, we would do the exact same thing. Yes.
So to the extent we focused on this coupling, decoupling of good faith and reasonable basis, as I understand your argument, you equate getting involved in protracted litigation to show that you had no liability as one of the risks that was assumed in the second part of the clause. And since you went to a good lawyer who's an expert in this field who raised these concerns, you acted in good faith, even if that legal advice was incorrect.
Exactly. If you look at the language of the termination provision, it allows us to terminate if we have a reasonable basis in law and in fact to be concerned that we will incur any, it uses the word any, liability related to asbestos. That's extremely, extremely broad. So,
well,
yes.
That's not what it says, does it? It says material liability for any asbestos-related claim.
Any. I need to get the language of the provision, but any liability on any material liability on any asbestos-related claim, yes.
So that's a claimant of somebody who's got a disease derived from asbestos, right?
Correct. My point is that there's nothing in that language, which is an argument that they're making for the first time essentially today, picking up on something I think Justice Steele said last time. There's nothing in the language of that provision that says the only liabilities you can worry about are judgments.
So, and that was going to be my question. So you're including legal expenses within – legal expenses are covered by the word liability.
They are, and I say that for several reasons. First, because I think the plain language of the provision gives it to you. It simply says any liability. Second, the document I referred to earlier, B91 in the record, which is the summary, the contemporaneous summary of the lawyer's opinion and the analysis, shows that Platinum understood it that way at the time, because what it says is, since Roan will be a shell or may have ceased to exist, plaintiffs will seek to impose liability against a successor to Roan's business, such as P. Frank. It can be reasonably anticipated that P. Frank will be subject to material liability in defending such claims and, if unsuccessful, paying any claims. So that shows that at the time, this is how Platinum, at least, interpreted it. The other, I think, salient point is that at no point prior to today has Roan ever advanced the argument that the termination provision did not encompass defense costs. The evidence that we put on at trial was never that we were going to incur a judgment. The opinion of counsel was that we would be exposed to claims. The expert that we put on the stand testified that we would suffer $35 million or more in defense costs.
So is there a meaningful distinction between the phrase exposed to claims and material liability for a claim?
I don't think the language of the provision makes that distinction. I think the words any liability on an asbestos-related claim should be read fairly to include the amount you'll have to pay defending that claim.
So that is a liability. Claims from your own attorneys, then, not people who have asbestos-related disease. Claims from your own lawyers who are defending you.
Claims, fees charged by my lawyers defending claims asserted by people suffering from asbestos-related diseases.
Well, your opponent says that material liability for any asbestos-related claim is a term of art, that material liability, whether it's in tort law, whether it's in insurance coverage law, whatever, that has meaning in itself, and it means, in effect, there's a substantial chance that there will be a judgment against you on an asbestos-related claim, and that is distinct from the cost associated with defending yourself from claims that turn out to be non-material, frivolous, or insubstantial. Why is he wrong to characterize that as a term of art that has that kind of meaning?
Well, if he is in fact saying that, he's saying it for the first time today. He didn't argue it to the trial court. He didn't argue it in his briefs to this court. As to why he would be wrong if he's saying that for the first time today, I fall back again on the language, which I think is very broad. If you look up in Black's Law Dictionary, liability is just a very broad term. There's no reason, I think, from the face of this provision to imagine that it doesn't include millions of dollars of defense costs that you would incur from defending asbestos-related claims. And frankly, it wouldn't make sense for it not to. Well, why would Platinum sign a contract that allows it?
I understand, though, how these claims are going to get anywhere if, in fact, you pay fair value for the towers and then they come against you. Why wouldn't your response be, go get the money? You know, we bought the towers. We paid fair value. We've got no responsibility. If you think somebody has responsibility, it's the person we paid for the towers and they got the money.
I'll answer your question, Justice Holland, but I would preface my answer by saying the answer ultimately I don't think matters, because we had a lawyer who gave us good faith advice that this was a problem. Putting that to the side, I think that it may well have ultimately been the answer, but we would have had to litigate it potentially in courts across the country.
Well, are we back to what is simply you never act in bad faith, and therefore you act in good faith when you rely on what appears to be a credible lawyer giving a credible opinion? That's all you need to do in order to conclude that not only have you acted in good faith, but you accompanied that with a reasonable determination in law and fact that there could be material liability for asbestos-related claims. Does this all hinge on relying on the lawyer?
I think what it hinges on is, did we make a determination in good faith that we had the reasonable basis? We had a lawyer tell us that you do, in fact, have a reasonable basis. The lawyer was qualified. He was informed. And so, yes, I submit that relying on qualified, informed counsel establishes good faith.
And you're saying that would take care of everything. So to the extent, hypothetically, legal fees wasn't included in everyone else's understanding of the word liability. But if your lawyer thought liability included liability for legal fees, and that's what you were told, then you acted in good faith.
As much as I would like to say yes in candor, I can't, because the good faith that's at issue here is our good faith in believing that we had a reasonable basis in law and in fact to incur material asbestos liability.
Well, outside of the lawyer's opinion, was there anything else that allowed you to form the view that there was a reasonable basis in law and fact to conclude that there would be material liability for asbestos-related claims?
No, I think our case rests on the premise that the lawyer's advice gave us a good faith basis to make the determination we did.
Well, how do we, so this means that if one lawyer said no, you have no liability risk, and another lawyer says yes, you can rely on the one who says yes, disregard the one that says no. I mean, how do you sort through it if there's conflicting opinions, as there were in this case, because you were told from the other side that there's no basis, right? So which one is the one that you can rely upon in good faith?
I think that's going to be a matter of fact, you know, for the individual case. In this case, the advice that we got from the lawyer that we had retained, you know, whose qualifications that we were familiar with and that we were paying and trusted, was unequivocal from start to finish that we had a reasonable basis here.
But we talked about this the last time. As I understand the scenario, and correct me if I'm wrong, the first criticism of your lawyer's advice was it was based on a memo from a junior person in the firm and hadn't been given a lot of thought. And then when your client indicated we're not going to go forward, your legal department had a full opportunity to make their best case to your lawyer, and your lawyer adhered to his position. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And I want to. We're in a situation, if we want to make an analogy, where you go to a heart surgeon or a heart doctor, and the heart doctor says to you, I think if you climb up the mountain, you've got a real potential health hazard, and you decide not to climb up the mountain, and your position is you should be able to rely on the expert legal opinion you got in this case.
That is our position. And I want to, at the risk of taking on a question that's not asked, there's been this notion in the briefs from the other side that what we are espousing here is some sort of general advice of counsel defense to breach of contract. And that's just a straw man that Rowan has erected. Nobody is suggesting here that any time you want to breach a contract, you just have to get your lawyer to tell you it's okay. That would be ridiculous. What we're arguing is that under the language of this specific contract, which included a provision that says if you in good faith determine there's a reasonable basis you can terminate, that you can cite reliance on advice of counsel as the basis for your good faith in determining that the reasonable basis necessary to terminate existed. I would take on...
Well, your opponent said that you could have written, this could have been written in a way that if you got advice of counsel, whether it's good or bad, that would be a basis for a walkaway, but that it's not written that way. Is there something in the record that shows the intent to accomplish the same thing through this language?
There is, and I think there's a finding on that fact in the court's opinion. The testimony in court was that this provision, and the finding in the court's opinion, was that this provision was inserted at the request of Platinum. When it came time to sign the deal, Platinum had not yet had an opportunity to finish its asbestos-related diligence. And so at that point, it has two options. It can walk away and scrap the deal, or it can address it in the contract. And so what it elects to do is put a provision here that says, we'll sort of extend our diligence period into a post-signing period. That will allow us to do the further investigation we need, and we will retain the freedom to act based on what we find. That's the only way Platinum would be willing to go forward with a deal that, you know, the record shows was valued at approximately $8 million when there's this, you know, $35 million risk out there. And it's also important to understand that this
means nothing directly within that, at least that expressly says, that we can rely on our lawyer's advice that we have this risk and walk away when we get such advice.
There's nothing in there that expressly says that. What it says is our determination will be in good faith. And then I would answer that you look to New York law for what good faith means. And that's where the Dalton case becomes relevant. Dalton tells you that you act in good faith where you do not act arbitrarily or irrationally. So then the question becomes, when you have a party faced with having to make a decision that turns on the answer to a complex legal question, can you say that that party is acting irrationally or arbitrarily when it consults expert counsel, hears his opinion, and acts on it? And when we submit, that's just not a defensible position. Under what New York law defines to be good faith, in this circumstance, we satisfied it. And the court explicitly found that.
Could we go back to the $35 million legal fee exposure issue? Where did that information come from? Did it come from the K&E lawyer, or was that evidence developed during the trial stage?
The number was developed during the trial stage. The evidence
that
from
wasn't
the
part of what you were told by K&E.
No, what we were told by K&E was that if the injunction was lifted, plaintiffs across the country and the asbestos bar would potentially sue you.
But there was no quantification of that.
There was no quantification, but I would respectfully submit there's a general understanding among sophisticated business people that once you become an asbestos defendant, that's going to be a very, very expensive proposition. We called Dr. Rabinowitz at trial as an expert to, in essence, corroborate K&E, and she was the one who put the $35 million figure on. We also had, I should note, my colleague helpfully reminds me, we had reports from the UNR trust that was set up to handle these asbestos claims that we were afraid might be redirected toward us. And if you look at the numbers in those reports, it shows that there were something like 300,000 outstanding claims. So we knew at the time that we were not talking about one or two or a dozen claims. There were hundreds of thousands that could potentially be shunted our way.
Tell me how, looking at the full language, material liability for any asbestos-related claim arising from any activity prior to the completion of seller's bankruptcy proceedings. How would legal fees that are incurred in the present arise from activity prior to the completion of seller's bankruptcy proceedings?
Because it would be the activity those decades ago that gave rise to the diseases that the people would be suing to be compensated for. And so you would be spending legal fees to defend claims arising out of conduct that took place during the UNR era.
Even though the services are all in present context.
Correct. Again, it goes back to our point that we read and we believe, both the contemporaneous evidence and the language of the provision supports the view that any liability is meant to include counsel fees. And I come back to the point that it wouldn't make sense for Platinum to have signed the contract otherwise. Because then what you have is a situation in which you say, all right, I'm signing a deal, which I estimate to be worth $8 to $10 million. I am undertaking or I'm accepting a risk that by doing that deal, I might be subject to $35 million in legal fees. And no rational business person would do that. But that's in essence what you would be doing if you said defense costs were excluded from the asbestos termination provision. It wouldn't be a decision that any business person would make.
But the fact is, what you were told, since it wasn't quantified at the time, is that if you sign the deal and the channeling injunction doesn't hold, there are 300,000 potential plaintiffs that could bring suit against you.
In summary, yes.
And whether that was quantified or not, it was easy for you to assume that would be a big number.
Yes. I would agree with that. I have just about 2.5 minutes left. I'll make one other point. And then I'll sit down, which was to address your question, Justice Jacobs, about whether or not we had an objectively reasonable basis. I think it all turns on, frankly, and again, I emphasize, we get to this only if you find that the good faith standard of review doesn't apply. The key point here is the channeling injunction, we believe, did not satisfy Section 524H. And the key error the court made in this regard, which I think you're correct that is a legal determination reviewed de novo, is that the opinion of Elizabeth Warren, one of the nation's leading bankruptcy scholars, that you can read Section 524H in a manner that would not cover the UNR channeling injunction was absurd and completely unreasonable. The court essentially said, if you look at the legislative history, you see that it can't be squared with what Elizabeth Warren said with her reading of the statute. And our response, as we've laid out in the brief, is this. No responsible lawyer would ever tell his client that you can rely on a court going past the language of a statute to get to the legislative history. You would never bet your house on that. But that's exactly what the court said that Platinum should have been expected to do. And again, once the channeling injunction falls away, the 300,000 claims come into the picture, and the millions of dollars of defense costs follow from that.
But wasn't Judge Del Pesco also concerned that your expert seemed to be extolling the virtues of channeling agreements when she testified before Congress?
I don't know that she was concerned about it. I think if the fact is that's true, but I think all that gets you is our expert candidly admitted she believes that channeling injunctions are constitutional and if challenged would be upheld. That's a separate question from how much is it going to cost for you to get there. And then the final point I would make would be just with regard to the satisfaction clause authorities that Roan has repeatedly cited. I would just emphasize that contrary to Roan's argument, they do not establish a mandatory reading of any contract. As Justice Ridgely pointed out a few moments ago, parties always remain free to contract on any terms they want, and you can incorporate a good faith standard as the parties did here. And in fact, their cousin's case, which they rely on and cite primarily, makes the very point at page 153. Whether the standard for contract performance is objective or subjective is a matter of intent. And here we submit that the language of the contract and the drafting history found by the court evidences that the party's intent here was to impose a good faith standard of review and that we satisfied good faith.
Thank you very much.
What has been heard from counsel for Platinum Equity, I would submit with respect, can't possibly be the guide for this court in determining this appeal. We would have an absolutely standardless environment in which people's subjective tolerance or ability to stomach the thought of future legal fees in successfully defending cases allowed them to trigger walkaway provisions that don't mention legal fees, don't even mention opinions of counsel, and instead contract for, as Justice Ridgely's pointed out, contract voluntarily for a very specific standard, one that is objective. This is not the first time we've raised this issue. In fact, in our response brief, on this point about legal fees, we said it very well on page 3. I'm just going to read it very quickly because I'm not sure I can say it any better. Platinum concludes in its answering brief by essentially conceding the Superior Court's finding that Platinum had no reasonable basis in law and fact to expect to succeed to material asbestos liability merely from purchasing Roan's non-asbestos cell tower assets for fair value. However, Platinum contends that this misses the point because future litigants would have ignored the law and sued Platinum anyway, forcing Platinum, in its view, to incur millions in legal fees in defense. This is mere sophistry. If the only undisclosed liabilities required under a termination provision to terminate a contract are imaginary defense costs for non-existent claims, then any asset purchase agreement could be terminated by whim. It's not the law, and to Justice Ridgely's point, it's specifically not what they contracted for. They could have. They could have said, we can walk away from this deal if we get an opinion from counsel. Then, perhaps, a good faith standard might have applied. If you get an opinion of counsel from an 11th grader, that wouldn't satisfy it. If you get an opinion from counsel from Kirkland and Ellis, perhaps it would. But that misses the whole point. That wasn't even the operative standard. They've never appreciated that. They don't even appreciate it today. The operative standard was objectivity. It was written into the agreement. And in addition, even if it hadn't been written in the agreement and only the word good faith had appeared, New York law controlled this transaction, and New York law tells you that unless we're talking about things of whim or taste, paintings, cakes, and the like, you look at a commercial transaction, and under the restatement and under the UCC, you do exactly what Justice Jacobs did when he was Vice Chancellor Jacobs. He said, you can't decouple good faith and a reasonable basis. You have to have a reasonable basis. Those aren't two alternative trapdoors for you. That's what Platinum didn't understand, and that's why the guide that Platinum is attempting to give this court is inadequate to decide this case. What Platinum is suggesting effectively translates that language talking about a reasonable basis in law and fact simply means if I consulted with a lawyer and I'm now uneasy, I can walk away. That misses the mark by a million miles. Now, they could have contracted for something akin to that. They simply didn't. And they have to live with the fact that the contract they entered into specified a different trigger to this walkaway provision. It's not worried about legal fees, and to Justice Ridgely's point, it's beyond Rule 11. The only party that ever challenged this was held in contempt of court. Not just Rule 11, they were held in contempt of court. These folks had no asbestos liability. They terminated the agreement in a baseless way. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Take the case under advisement and adjourn.